What's up, guys? This is Tony Angus. Welcome to Chat Time, where I have a conversation with interesting people about the world we live in and the things that matter to us most. Join me each week for a sometimes fun, sometimes controversial, sometimes enlightening, but always enjoyable chat. Today I'm speaking with Joe Saunders. Joe is a violence management expert, lifelong martial artist, and conflict management consultant. He's the host of the Managing Violence podcast and the Presilience podcast. He's written several articles for several security and martial arts magazines, as well as a memoir of his early years as a young martial artist entering the nightclub security scene. I think you'll find this interview really interesting. Please give it up for Joe Saunders. Joe, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
Perhaps, Joe, if you'd start, just tell the listeners what you're about and your background and a little bit of a sort of an expurgated version of your bio.
Yeah, sure. So I guess the Cliff Notes version is I grew up as a martial artist. I grew up training in all different martial arts because my family moved around a lot when I was young. So every town had, I was sort of given a selection of here's the martial arts that are available and cheap.
Yep.
And got dropped off at the PCYC or the Boys Club or the YMCA or whatever it is, and I would train and whatever. Growing up, I kind of disliked study again constantly because I felt like I could never get past green belt in anything because I was constantly restarting. But as an adult, it became a benefit because I had a lot of reference points for different concepts as I started getting deeper. As a teenager, I got much more seriously about grappling. I started off with wrestling, amateur wrestling. And then after about 18 months of wrestling, I switched to judo for the sake of competition.
Mm-hmm.
Managed to get to an international level in judo, which was, very cool.
Yeah, very cool.
And that led me into Brazilian jiu-jitsu, sumo wrestling. I represented Australia in sumo wrestling.
Did you?
Yeah. and belt wrestling as well, which is an Eastern European style of traditional wrestling. So I got to travel the world, throwing people around and getting thrown around.
Nice.
And but on a professional level, I had started teaching self-defense when I was about 18 years old. And that was also the time I decided I was at university studying psychology, and I was broke, as every psych student is.
Yeah.
And was kind of sick of the regular jobs, and I decided I was going to get my security license and start bouncing in nightclubs to pay the bills and have a little bit of freedom. And that was only supposed to last me for the summer, and it ended up being 5 years.
Yeah.
and that was my first real exposure to violence in an unregulated environment.
Yes, correct.
I wasn't someone who grew up in a quite happy family. I wasn't exposed to a lot of violence. I often say when I tell this story that the first fight of my adult life was 5 minutes into my first shift as a bouncer. And
yeah.
That was like, welcome to reality. This is what you're dealing with now. And it was a good filter for me to look at all the martial arts I'd learned and see what was appropriate, what wasn't.
Mm.
And of course, you know, being 18, 19 years of age, I was still looking at all these conflicts as physical problems that required a physical solution, not necessarily a tactical or strategic solution, which
mm-hmm.
we'll get to later.
Mm-hmm.
But that was my first exposure, I guess, to workplace violence or occupational violence, and very much on the pointy end, quite literally, on the front lines of working in security. Still studying psychology. I used to joke that I learned far more about psychology on the weekends than I did in the lecture theatre.
Mm.
But that moved on. My first professional role outside of the security industry was working for Queensland Health as a occupational violence prevention and aggressive behaviour management instructor.
Wow.
That was a big business card.
Yeah.
And that was basically teaching frontline healthcare professionals how to deal with, customer aggression, but patient aggression.
Mm.
Yeah, client aggression.
Mm.
And that was that was excellent for me as an instructor because in any given classroom, I would have potentially senior registered nurses or even doctors sitting right next to the food services workers, the operational services people, electricians sometimes, right?
Yeah.
You'd have people from all different backgrounds. And as an instructor, being able to articulate concepts such as acute intoxication or mental health conditions in a way that doesn't destroy my credibility to the learned sections of the audience, but also makes it understandable to those who really need layman's terms. Mm. That was a really interesting challenge for me as a young instructor. I did that when I was about 24. So
that's good grounding.
Yeah, but that what that actually did, and we're talking offline about Damien Martin.
Yeah.
Damien was actually Queensland Health's contracted trainer. He developed the instructor program for the Aggressive Behaviour Management program for Queensland Health. And I got to sit under Damien's learning tree for 4 weeks, a paid course, which was fantastic. Best thing my tax dollars ever paid for.
Yeah.
I got to learn under Damien for 4 weeks, and I was being paid to train with him for during business hours, and I'd stick around and do his karate classes after hours and hang out.
Mm.
And that was really interesting because it was the first time I'd really been exposed to a lot of other concepts, like really getting a firm grounding of the law, getting a firm grounding of the Mental Health Act, getting a firm grounding of intoxication, mental health conditions, geriatric disorders, all these other things that go into conflict and aggression in the real world.
Mm.
And I wasn't new to reality-based self-defense. I wasn't quite an instructor under Richard Dimitri, but I started training under Richard Dimitri of Senshido. So I was doing a lot of reality-based training and a lot of verbal de-escalation training. But I think the Queensland Health experience gave me a lot more of an academic grounding to really understand why we do it the way we do it.
Yeah.
And more importantly, if anything you do is questioned, how you need to explain it. Because you can do the right thing and explain it poorly and still be in trouble.
Yeah, that's exactly right, yeah. So yeah. Do you think there's a misconception about occupational violence, and a lot of people will lump it into the bad behaviour category where someone will say, this guy has come into my workplace, come into the emergency department of a hospital, for example.
Mm-hmm.
You've got a nurse or a receptionist who's working there at emergency. You've got somebody who's come in and they're angry, and they'll say to you, oh, we had a guy badly behaved in here today.
Mm-hmm.
Or we've had somebody who was violent. But they're ability and willingness to break that down into further categories of what kind of violence are we dealing with that then guides your response. You find that being one of the issues?
Absolutely. And I think we dehumanize the aggressor.
Yes.
Too much. I used to say, no one's having a good time at 3 a.m. in an emergency department.
No.
Right? If you're in the emergency department and you're not being paid to be there at 3 o'clock in the morning, something has gone wrong. Either you are in significant duress yourself because of a health condition or intoxication or whatever, or you've just been given that worst phone call that every parent hates, that something has happened to someone you love, and you're in a waiting room, you're tense, you're panicking. No one's going to be their best selves at that moment.
It's pretty rare that somebody chooses the cafe within a hospital to go and have their lunch unless they're in a hospital for some dire reason, you know, and even if it's been good news, the whole hospital environment is full of negative, you know, consequences and connotations. The fact that I'm in there means that I'm either ill or injured. Someone I love or know is ill or injured.
Mm.
And, you know, it rolls from there. So people's mindset in that moment is not one of, and that's why I was getting at it, to put the label of bad behavior on these people.
Yeah, yeah. It's like, well, they're just criminals.
Yeah.
Or and that was a learning for me too, because coming from the security world,
yeah,
you do tend to dehumanize the people that don't behave well.
Yeah.
Because it makes the job easier. If you can just say, okay, I can identify you're going to be a problem in about 2.5 drinks time.
Yeah.
I see this group coming. I can just refuse them entry straight away because I know.
Mm.
I don't know why I know, but I know that you're going to be a problem.
Which is fine because that's a really important skill to have.
Of course it is. But you can't do it in every environment.
No.
So, I mean, you can't just refuse someone treatment that has a health condition, for example. Or in an industry we both worked in, the public transport sector. You can't just tell someone they're not allowed to get on a train because you think they might be a problem.
Yeah.
There's going to be issues. So
yeah, so what we can do, and I look at it like a book where they'll make these glib statements, you can't judge a book by its cover. Well, which is nonsense because we all do.
Mm.
Let's just get that on the table. Everybody does. But you can't stop there. So it's not like any of the books that are on my shelf. You can say I've read them if I've only looked at the cover.
Mm-hmm.
So what we've got to do with people is look at the cover and we make an assessment then. Then you turn the page and you might read the prologue, you might read the blurb, and you make another assessment. then you read the first chapter and you make continuous assessments. And understanding people's behavior is very much like that, where you've got to keep your observations going minute to minute.
Absolutely. It's just about not shutting the door on further information.
Mm.
I mean, I can make an assumption based on what I see from somebody.
Mm.
If I see someone walking towards me and they're dressed a certain way, they look a certain way, they're walking a certain way, their head's moving a certain way, their mouth's moving a certain way, I can have a fairly good idea of how the interaction's going to go, but I shouldn't ever switch off to being wrong and being proven wrong.
Mm.
And this, I mean, it's really interesting, this COVID period that we're in at the moment. You see that. I mean, the people that would normally you'd never see outside of corporate attire, you're now seeing on Zoom in their pajamas, just about.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
Everyone's in T-shirt. I've had clients that I've known for years, and I'm like, I didn't know you had tattoos.
Yeah,
it's
right.
Like, it's just something different about the person, right?
Yeah.
They don't normally let on. And that person, coming back to our emergency room scenario, that person who looks unkempt at 3 o'clock in the morning, like if you fast forward 6 hours' time, he might be a completely different person.
Yeah.
Right? But right now, he's just got a call saying his son's been in a motorbike accident. Right? And he's down the shop, down at the hospital with his ruggers and his flip-flops because he had to get out the door quickly, and he doesn't look like...
Well, that's you and I in 12 hours if something happens to us.
Exactly,
and,
100%.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's just a bit... And really, the underlying thing I always come back to with any sort of violence and aggression is the most important thing we can develop is empathy.
Yeah.
It's not about justifying behavior. It's not about excusing behavior, because there are limits on what you should be willing to excuse. But it's about understanding how they got there. And it doesn't matter. I've done a lot of work on de-escalation training and research. And I firmly believe that unless you have empathy for someone, you can never de-escalate them.
Mm.
The best thing you'll do is you'll trick them into calming down. But that's not the same as de-escalation.
No, it's not. And I think that a lot of people just don't buy it. Unless there's a measure of genuineness and sincerity to it, that, okay, I'm calming down because your words are appropriate and you're in whatever uniform, you're in a nurse's uniform, a security uniform, whatever you are, a conductor on a train. And so I'm willing to play the game, but I haven't developed any trust and any rapport. There's no bond between us because your words are empty.
Exactly.
And that's what people misunderstand. I've had many people say, yeah, but they don't deserve it.
Yeah, well, that you're immediately shut off to any possibility of a relationship.
Yes, right? Agreed.
And you're shut off to any positive communication. The second you think that someone doesn't deserve your time or doesn't deserve your mental energy, then you are as much a part of the escalation as anybody else.
Yes, and I think that's what they misunderstand, is that they are a contributor to what's taking place. That I talk about a milkshake. If you imagine that your interaction with me, you're putting a flavor in that milkshake, my interaction with you, I'm also flavoring that milkshake, that 100%. Transaction. And it, regardless of how negative or off-tasting yours is, if I add fish into that milkshake, it's disgusting, you know? So
exactly. We
have to teach people, and people need to understand that they've got to put something appropriate into that milkshake.
And there's so much that goes into this. I mean, we could do a whole podcast about de-escalation and probably do a series, but the... one of the things that I find is that otherwise well-meaning people, and I think this is why people like us will always have a role to fill, is that there are people that don't have any skills to deal with conflict, and they've lived a quite charmed existence where they've never had to think about real violence and real conflict, and that's a good thing, but there's always going to be a role for people that have to educate those people about how to stay safe from when it does visit, and that's what I see my role as is, it's not about, you know, I could come out and I could train the commandos and the police and whatever. And that's cool. And they need training as well. Don't get me wrong. But there are a lot of good people that will not otherwise become exposed to it until it's too late.
Yeah.
And those are the people that I think need just a soft touch, just a little bit of a little bit of awareness. And what I come back to, the reason I went on that tangent, I was sitting with a client, a federal government client, reviewing some CCTV of some incidents that went poorly. And I saw a manager of a particular site come out to try and de-escalate a customer who was aggressive. And everything about that person indicated that they had no experience with conflict, right? They didn't show any appropriate body language of keeping themselves safe. they were nervous and timid from the get-go. But as the verbal altercation started, you started to see this manager get closer and closer and closer. They put their hands on the subject, on the customer. They thought they were doing it in a reassuring manner, but they still touched them. They're not even within punching range, they're now in headbutt range. Like, they were close. Mm-hmm. Now, when that manager was interviewed afterwards, they felt they'd kept the appropriate 2 meter distance.
Yes.
Because their perception of the event was completely different to what was shown on the CCTV.
Of course.
There was a lot of other things that happened too. Like, it was clear that the customer had taken a dislike to that particular person, but there was no disengagement or tag teaming or anything to get that person out of there. The original source of the conflict was still there, buzzing around, being useless. Mm. And that's not a judgment on them. Just when you are the face they don't like, don't be there. Mm. They followed him outside, way outside the jurisdiction as he was leaving, which prompted him to come back again. Like, there's so many little things that a little bit of knowledge would have prevented.
And a lot of those things are common.
Yeah, they got emotionally involved. That's all it was. They got emotionally involved.
Correct. I find in almost every environment, if I've had to go back and listen or look or read over a particular incident, a lot of the things you've described have taken place, but and exactly as you described, the person involved was unaware of those little things, and I think largely because they're not in their prefrontal cortex, they're not assessing, they're kind of immersed in it, they're being in either fight or flight or some emotional state at the moment, and so their environment awareness, their relative positioning, their communication skills are all up the putt. And then, of course, later on, in the self-justification bias, they want to go and say, well, but hang on, I thought I did a really good job here. I find that common in almost every industry I work at. Mm-hmm. And I think as well, you mentioned earlier that it's nice to have people that have had no violence in their history and talk to those people about how to manage. It's also, I think, important to talk to people who live in this dog-eat-dog, kill or be killed world and soften their skills.
Absolutely.
So that there's a tableau of skills that are available, and we need to be able to give people the spectrum so that, you know, you can empathize on this end and you can just sit and have a chat and be use negotiation skills, and then you can work your way through to needing to restrain or de-escalate or knock someone out at that end.
Mm-hmm.
But and there are all this, there's a plethora of skills that exist in that spectrum.
Absolutely.
And it's never ending.
Yeah, and what's really interesting is that there really are two worlds. You know, the skills that make you successful as a white-collar business person living an affluent lifestyle, if that all gets ripped out from under you and you end up on the streets, those skills aren't going to mean much.
No.
And you are now fighting for survival in a completely different world of people who don't care how much money you used to have.
Mm.
If anything, it'll probably bring you the wrong kind of attention in case you still have some of it.
True.
And vice versa, you have people that have grown up in poverty, grown up around violence and drugs and alcohol, and then they've gone to prison where those same skills are still valuable. And then they get out and they try to turn their lives around, but the skills they've spent the last 20 or 30 years of their life building aren't directly applicable to the civilized, quote-unquote, civilized world. And I think when that happens, it's really easy to go back into that environment where your skills are useful. Mm. And it takes a real big effort in either direction to acclimatize to a new reality. So on my show, the Managing Violence Podcast, I've had the fortune to interview a couple of people that have been in prison for violence and drugs. And it is really interesting hearing their story about their experience with violence. Some of them, like I had a guy named Michael Van Beek, who's a martial arts instructor, and he was quite a well-known martial arts instructor already. He was an MMA fighter. He was an instructor under Paul Vunak. And then drugs and alcohol entered his life, and he ended up losing everything, ended up on the street as a credentialed martial artist, well-respected, featured in Black Belt magazine. Now he's living on the street fighting for survival.
Wow.
And then had to go through a period of incarceration and rehabilitation, and then managed to get his life back. That's quite an interesting story. And then I've also had someone like Varg Freeborn, who grew up surrounded by violence and alcohol and drugs, and where, I can't remember exact, but a large number of his family were either murdered or in jail.
Right.
Because that was just his social network.
Yeah.
it was expected he would go to jail at some point in his life. And he ran with the wrong people. He ended up in a situation where two guys were coming for him, and he ended up stabbing the one of the guys that was coming after him 27 times.
Mm-hmm.
The guy lived, but he still went to jail for attempted murder, even though it was seemed to be self-defense. He then, after a long period of incarceration, got out and has now managed to restore his civil rights and is now a trainer for law enforcement and tactical teams in the US. So very, very interesting stories, but there is a massive transition to be able to succeed on both sides of that line. And I think that's coming back to our original topic of conversation. Sometimes we are going to be confronted by people that live in that other world.
Yeah.
And if you work in an area where you're going to have exposure to those people, whether it's healthcare, whether it's government services, whether it's public transport, whether it's taxi driving, security, whatever it is, you're going to have exposure to people that live in a different world to you.
Mm.
And they're going to have different customs to you, and they're going to have different insecurities to you, and they're going to have different rules of contact to you. And they might be very good at playing your game, but they're a foreigner. And you've got to be able to understand enough of their culture to not step on the tripwires.
A lot of it comes down to base level values, doesn't it?
Absolutely.
And so if I believe that I'm in this world as, and it's a dog eat dog world, that's what I believe. So my belief system is that unless you show yourself as being strong, you don't give any quarter, you look after your own problems, you don't go to law enforcement because
mm-hmm.
they're a bunch of dogs.
Mm-hmm.
You keep things in house and you deal with it through violence or mm-hmm. through threats of violence. And if somebody does something to you, the payback is extreme.
Mm.
And if a person who lives in that, just by you trying to explain that that's a perception of the world they live in based on their beliefs and their history and all that, that's not necessarily true, there's where you hit this brick wall because it is true to them.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so you find yourself saying, talking, almost hitting your head against the brick wall, because they're just going to say back to you, no, if you don't stand strong, they will stand over you. They will take what's yours. They will make, they will humiliate you. They'll put you down. And it's very difficult. But equally on the other side, the white collar workers, yep. the lawyers and accountants that have never had an angry word spoken to them,
yep.
their perception of the real world is entirely different.
Well, it's even simpler than white collar, blue collar, or white collar unemployed, whatever you want to say. But it's really about whether you trust a society of laws or you don't.
Yes.
It's like if you I know a lot of lawyers, just to pick up one profession, who in any other profession would be punched in the mouth daily.
Yeah, right? That's right. Yeah.
But
probably nearly punched in the mouth daily in their profession.
Exactly. Right? But they know they're protected by a system of laws, yep. And litigation and the ability to, extract large amounts of money if that were to happen.
Mm.
If that same person acted the same way in a bar where no one knew who they were, it'd be completely different.
Yeah.
But I think when you cross over that line of, I'm not relying on the police and I've got nothing for you to sue me for, so therefore it's between you and me, it's a different world.
Yeah.
And I think one of the things we talk about a lot in training is Maslow's hierarchy of needs.
Nice, and I was going to go there.
Yeah, so for most of us, myself, yourself included, like we don't really have concerns on a day-to-day basis about those base layers. Right? Our safety and security is pretty much guaranteed. Our health is pretty much guaranteed. We live in a first world country.
Mm-hmm.
If anything happens where we lose work or we lose a job, there is a safety net. Like very few people starve to death in Australia.
Mm-hmm.
If I call 000, someone will come.
Mm-hmm.
These are not norms globally. Like this is a privilege that we have that... Yeah, that someone will come to save me. They might not be as quick as I want them to be, but they'll still come. If I have a medical emergency with one of my children, I can get them to hospital very quickly. I will not be losing my entire rest of my life's income paying for the medical bills. We are privileged. So we don't think about those levels, and therefore we don't build resilience at those levels.
Mm.
What we think about is the higher level of self-actualization, love and belonging and relationships, and that's why we can have arguments over something like The Bachelor, right? We can watch reality TV and we assign life and death significance to very trivial issues because we don't have real life or death struggles to worry about.
Yeah, there's a lot of those sayings about the, the man that goes to war is a different, perspective on life. And obviously having lived that base level thing, about your base level survival. Am I going to live through this encounter? It makes everything above that on the pyramid seem trivial at the moment. Everything.
Well, exactly.
Now, the more you're exposed then to the obviously the safety, but then your basic needs of food and shelter and warmth, and then love and acceptance, and then self-acceptance, self-worth, and it allows you to go, okay, I'm already there. I have those. Mm-hmm. I can at least reach for self-actualization.
Yep.
But if you're on the battlefield, that reaching to self-actualization seems ludicrous.
Well, if you're homeless on the street,
yeah,
and you're just trying to make sure you have enough food,
shelter,
or shelter, you don't care if you're lonely.
No,
like it doesn't even occur to you that I wish I had a girlfriend. Yeah. Like, no, it's not even a little bit.
Someone
right?
to take to a restaurant and a movie. Like
it's not. I don't want to be a self-actualized homeless person, right? It's not something that even occurs to you because your day to day activities, and this is not just now, suburban Melbourne. Like, I was teaching a course for a women's shelter in Alice Springs.
Nice.
And just one of those random gigs that comes up at the time. And I was basically doing a course in aggression management and security awareness for them. And two of the people on the course, two of the care or social workers on the course, were both from South Sudan. And they're both young. They're both early 20s, mid 20s females.
Mm-hmm.
And they had both been involved in the ethnic wars in South Sudan as children. And they hadn't been child soldiers, but they'd both had their villages basically wiped out and destroyed. And I'm talking about stress management to these people. And I'm talking about resilience. And I'm talking about, be able to regulate your heart rate. And these two girls who were both unknown to each other before they got to Australia, which is quite crazy. They're both in the same conflict, didn't know each other. Both ended up not only in Australia, but in Alice Springs working as social workers in the same center, which is crazy anyway.
Yeah.
But one of them was telling me a story of rebels coming to their village and basically killing everyone. And she hid under the corpses of her relatives and friends for 3 days until the post was basically all the enemy left. And she told me stories of having to wait for nightfall when the guards started sleeping so she could crawl through the corpses to get to water to bring back for her little brother. And I'm trying to tell her about resilience and stress management. it's a different level, isn't it? Right.
Well, of course, I imagine the people that hired you weren't really hiring you to talk to the South Sudanese.
That's right. That's right. But it's just perspective, alone, no matter.
Perspective.
You know, where I was at in terms of the majority of the rest of the people, like, sure, I could talk to them about this stuff, and it would be interesting. And then I felt like sitting back and going, can you please tell me more of your experiences? Because this is a level I haven't experienced.
Well, I think that's the nature of a facilitator, isn't it? That you come across information from a participant in the course that everybody should hear.
Absolutely.
You just put your student hat on and you go, listen, I'm going to throw to them
because
this highlights, better than the stories I had to tell,
this
highlights what I want to get across.
Absolutely.
I've done that dozens of times because there's always people in your course that have immense amount of knowledge. And you're 100% right. The level of resilience of a person who's lived through that, come out the other side, you'd have to expect that they could cope with almost anything. And it takes me to another question. How do you feel about today's modern first world complaints about safe spaces? And do you find that to be aggravating?
I do and I don't. I do if I allow myself to sort of
get to that level,
be negative about it.
Yeah.
But from a behavioral science point of view, I think human beings have evolved to always have a war to fight. Like we've always had an enemy. We've always had something to fight for. Whether it's just having enough food to get through winter, whether it's fighting off another tribe or another country or another province, whatever it is, we've always had a war to fight. And in the absence of something significant to fight against, we will find causes to fight for. I think it's innate part of human instinct that we have to have an enemy. And I think in the absence of a real threat, we will make minor threats seem more significant. And I don't think that's a bad thing. I think in general, because I think it allows us to continually progress. We don't just sit and go, well, this is status quo and this is quite comfortable, I'm just going to stay here. I think we continually evolve, but we do need to keep it in check and go, is this something? Is this the hill worth dying on? You know, because yeah. because it will divide our society. And we could have a much bigger discussion about, you know, the security engineering of grievances and dividing societies and so on. And I think that's a much bigger conversation to have about how much of it's legitimate and how much of it is engineered. But
well, I imagine, without going, we can go as deep into that as you want to. I mean, the world's your oyster at this stage. But it seems to me, if we go back to Maslow's hierarchy, right?
Mm.
They were pendulum swings of have not, have, and you anywhere in there. And then when you go into food and clothing and have or have not, but it's a smaller pendulum shift, it doesn't matter as much.
Yeah.
And so it just seems to me that we're swinging the pendulum between what really matters to us right now. But what I have a problem with is marching on the streets for this cause, you know, as if it's a complete have not. In the same way that having no food or shelter is a have not.
Yes.
The fact that you're there fully clothed with your full belly and enough money to buy a placard and a piece of card and write your cause.
Mm.
And you live in a country that allows you to express yourself freely and a government that will listen to protest actions.
Mm.
The pendulum swing is pretty minor compared to the homeless guy who may not eat tomorrow.
Exactly. And I think I probably understand it on a level that stops me from getting too angry about it. I do shake my head and go, you know, we are waiting for a third world wake-up call. And that's sort of how I tagged COVID was, you know, our first world privilege is getting a third world wake-up call.
Mm.
And I think our government did a good job of heading some of that off early on with the stimulus packages and the
Agreed.
Allowing people to access super and JobKeeper and JobSeeker and so on. I think because I saw some major crime on the horizon as people started losing their jobs, and all of a sudden the Maslow hierarchy started heading back towards the base where I've got to provide for my family and other people that would never have otherwise been criminals are now faced with the choice of, well, do I let my family starve?
Yeah.
Or do I go do what I got to do?
And also, the further you go down. When you look at the base model of the base of the Maslow's hierarchy pyramid, which he didn't draw, by the way, which is interesting. He came up with a concept, but the pyramid was someone else.
Mm.
But when you have a look at that base, you're really not engaging too much of your prefrontal cortex.
No.
It's really very much a survival mode that you're in. And what it does is it drops people out of their way away from the self-actualization strategic part of the brain. And then, of course, we wonder why they're behaving in a more animalistic manner. Well, because they're now functioning in the mammalian part of the brain more often. And so we can fully expect that the guy who was, you know, driving around in a really nice car, able to pay his mortgage, put food on the table, take the kids out to the movies, go on holidays and all that, who suddenly has no income.
Yep.
And we, of course, we can expect that he is going to now start acting emotionally and maybe acting out.
Mm-hmm.
So it's no surprise, is it?
Yeah, and I think just given current events, I mean, I know this, I'm not sure when this podcast will be released, but currently we've got some government housing areas in Melbourne that are under complete lockdown that was announced an hour before the police arrived that they were not going in or out.
Yeah.
These housing areas are disproportionately high in refugees and immigrant communities, some of whom probably have quite negative experiences of police suddenly taking over a building. And
100%.
And I think that's super important that we talk about empathy. Are the police officers that have been deployed to look after that community, to enforce a public health lockdown, are they fully across what the experiences of those people inside might be?
Oh, I doubt it.
And we're not talking about people who are going, oh, I'm going to have to eat canned food for 5 days. For some people, it's like, well, I'm not going to be able to, my dealer isn't going to be able to get in, and I can't get out, and I'm facing 5 days of heroin withdrawals.
Mm.
Like, that's a different beast. Mm. You know, this isn't an inconvenience for some people. This is life and death.
Mm.
Now, do they have appropriate social support on hand? Do they have appropriate linguistic support? Do they have counselors in different languages to be able to calm down the person who their last interaction with this was police rubber tires around them and set fire to them the last time they came into a village and locked them down?
Mm.
I don't know.
Yeah, but, a lot of people come from places where their understanding of law enforcement is violence, corruption, 100%. Brutality, and possibly driven by opposing religious viewpoints, or they're not even police, they're warlords.
Yeah.
We talk about the Sudanese, they live under a who knows what regime at any moment, because there'll be a coup, someone will take over, and he's just as brutal as the last dictator.
Yep.
And then they come to an Australia that is incredibly passive and incredibly middle class and incredibly law-abiding in the grand scheme of things.
Mm.
And suddenly they're expected to just turn their worldview around in the face of a police department that's now laying down restrictions.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, they're armed. They walk in with uniforms and carrying arms.
Yep.
So, yes, it must be, and I've often said this, we have to be fully respectful of cultural diversity and all the values and beliefs that it brings. Can't just say, well, you live in Australia now.
Yeah, that's right. There's a transition, right? And it's usually generational transition.
Yes, generational.
Yeah.
Because their parents are going to tell the stories to their kids about what they went through.
That's right.
And they're going to teach their kids based on what they went through. Mm-hmm. And so we have to get rid of that, not get rid of, but that generation has to pass. The kids have to grow and say, tell their kids, this is what it's like to live in Australia.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so,
there's no quick answers to this. And I look at what's happening in the US at the moment. Again, that's a generational issue. I mean, we're only, 60 years removed true equality, I guess, if you're going to call it that. That's not long enough.
It was 400 years of slavery, 60 years of uncomfortable lurching and two steps forward and one step back.
Mm.
60 years of making up for it is not enough.
And this is the first African American girl that went to a white school is only 65 years old.
Yeah, correct.
Right? I mean, that's recent history, but
yeah.
That's again, big topics. But I think what we've got to look at is how do we edge forward. And this is sometimes the problem with protests and demonstrations and social justice warriors and so on. I know a lot and I can empathize a lot with those that mean well.
Well, you empathize with their position immediately.
Exactly. But it's about what is the play here to actually achieve an objective? Because if you go too hard, too fast with demanding complete 180s, you alienate your entire community, or 50% of the community. And that's what we're seeing in the US at the moment. We have massive divides, and I think it's actually setting back race relations, not improving them.
In addition to that, don't you have the policymakers who are going, I can't acquiesce to your demands.
Mm.
You're asking too big a shift.
Exactly. I can't sell that.
You know? No.
It's in business, right? Sometimes you've got to sell the $5,000 pilot program to get in the door to sell the $100,000 cultural change program.
Yeah.
Right? Sometimes there's no appetite to buy the big thing straight away.
Well, also, you know, in a martial arts perspective, you start at white belt, you're selling them yellow belt, you're not selling them black belt necessarily.
Yeah, that's too hard.
It's too hard. And then people who will say, you know, it's going to take you 10 years to get to black belt, there are a lot of people who will be going, wait a minute, what? You know, I can't even see that.
Yeah.
But I can see 6 months in a yellow belt.
Yeah.
So it's really about asking these people who are in need to say, okay, I understand you want to cross this raging river. Let's not look to the other bank. Yep. Let's look to that first rock in the middle or on this close to this edge.
Mm.
How do we get to that point, not to that point?
Mm. I think bringing that conversation back full circle, really the key to any sort of de-escalation, and it doesn't matter whether we're talking about me and you having an argument over a spilled pint and trying to de-escalate this situation, or whether it's groups, whether it's different ideologies, whether it's countries at war, the principles are the same. It's about understanding what matters to you and how do I best facilitate what matters to you so you feel like you've gained something, you've had a win, without me losing something that I couldn't part with.
Yes.
And that's really what de-escalation is. For you, understanding our argument in a pub over a spilled pint, for you, if I've spilled my drink on you, what you're venting is, frustration.
Mm-hmm.
You want me to acknowledge that I was wrong.
Mm-hmm.
You want me maybe to buy you a beer.
Yeah. Pay the dry cleaning on my shirt
Man, here's $20. Like, how do you justify being angry now, right?
Correct.
And I've parted with $20 and saved myself having to go to a hospital or a police station or get kicked out of the bar, right?
Yeah.
That's de-escalation 101, right?
Yeah.
War's the exact same way. We negotiate by saying, okay, well, we're not prepared to give you this much territory, but how about what if we give you this part?
Yeah.
Or what if we give you these, this trade deal?
This concession.
Yeah. What if we lift this sanction? Yeah. And that way they save face, they walk away saying we got something.
Hmm.
We haven't been greatly hurt by it, and we've avoided hundreds of thousands of people dying.
And even if we, as a government, say our public, the public, are not going to accept this huge change, but if you're prepared to come this way one step, I'll go that way one step with a view to the next time we meet, we'll see how this has gone, the first two steps, and then we'll take the next step.
Yep.
And so, it's the difference I see is between you and me having an argument over spilled beer, I don't have anyone else to convince of the righteousness of me saying to you, I apologise, let me buy you a beer, unless I've got a mate going, don't buy him a beer.
Punch his face in. Aren't you a black belt?
Yeah, that
nonsense. They're the worst ones.
Yeah. Oh, aren't they though?
But yeah, no. Look, I fully agree. I think when I was working as a bouncer, one of the best strategies that I'm embarrassed to say I discovered way too late after about 2 years of doing it wrong was I realized that the majority of the people that escalated once you told them they had to leave. They got physical, and then you'd end up dragging them out. The vast majority of them, they weren't angry because you're telling them to leave. They were angry because they were going to be embarrassed.
Yeah.
Because they've been working on this girl or this group all night, and now they're going to be embarrassed and kicked out, and I'm going to look like a loser. And the number of situations that I think I probably avoided, and you can never really prove what you avoided, but just by grabbing someone when they're on their own and saying, mate, you've had too much. I'm going to ask you to leave, but I'm going to give you 5 minutes to make up an excuse, tell your group, and leave on your own accord. I'll watch you, so don't abuse the trust, but I'm going to let you do it on your own accord and head out.
Outstanding.
And that way, like, there's no bruised ego. There's no loss of face. I mean, they might still say, oh, really? Come on. So as long as you stick to your guns, then you're okay, because I'm not doing anything that's going to insult you. And if he's going to swing a punch over that, then, well, he gets what he gets. At that point, I mean, you've pretty much given him every way out.
Of course. Yeah. I mean, there are times when, and I've had a brief bouncing career as well, and there are times when no matter what strategy of de-escalation you want to bring, the guy's had too much of a skinful and he just wants to swing at your head.
Yeah.
Well, there's a response to that as well.
Yeah.
I'm the same as you. I stumbled on, it was... To be perfectly honest, a lazy night, and I just was like, I didn't want to be there. I was called in, and I remember watching these two guys, and they had been bumping into each other and snarling at each other from across the room. And, every time they crossed paths, it was a bit of verbal, and I just was like, oh, no. And I remember catching them in a moment when they were like a meter apart, and I just stood between them for a second. Like, fellas, this is what's going to happen. You know, you've paid money to get in here. You've paid money. Look around. There's music.
Mm.
It's a Friday night. You've been working all week. Look at them. Girls.
Yep.
They're dressed. They're wearing next to nothing. They're dancing. They're having a good time. You're here to have a good time. You paid to get in. And yet you two are giving each other greasies. Where's this going to end? Or you're going to miss out on the music, the beer, the girls. You're going to miss out.
Mm-hmm.
So I'll tell you what we're going to do. You turn and face that way and look at the girls over there. You face that way.
Mm.
I promise you, if you come together again, me, that big guy over there, we have to ask you to leave.
Mm.
And we don't want to.
Mm-hmm.
Stay, have a good time. Yeah, righto, boss. Yeah, So I reckon just jumping in early enough and seeing it develop and brew early enough, 100%. Then you go, all right, no, I don't want to have to put this guy in an arm lock and take him out of hammer lock and drag him downstairs. If I can just say to him, please, mate, please don't, for your own sake. Oh, all right then.
Yeah. And look, the earlier you get in before things escalate, like it's always easier to fix a problem before it escalates, right? It's easier to get your car serviced regularly than it is to replace a transmission, right? So it's one of those things that we apply to every area of life.
Yeah.
And yet Yeah, especially, you know, I know you and I both consulted in government. How many government departments have been aware of a problem and will ignore it for year after year after year until it becomes a massive issue?
Festers.
Yeah, and it's like, oh, now the media have got a hold of it. We need to get batten down the hatches, crisis mode. We need to fix it, right?
It's a cancer, you know. You get it as a little lump and then hopefully. I mean,
one of the things we do with my company is we do a lot of cultural change programs. Yeah. And culture doesn't change with a workshop. Culture is an ongoing thing. Mm. Like it requires hiring, it requires firing, it requires repositioning people.
Policies.
It requires, it's not a handout. It's not a workshop. It's not a PowerPoint presentation. It's not even an online training program. Mm. It's a ongoing process that takes time. But the good news from that is, like, yes, a good culture does take time to develop, but so does a bad culture. And if you are alert to the culture of your workplace, as something that Dr. Richard Diston, who's did his PhD in occupational violence in the UK, one thing he said to me when I interviewed him was that much of workplace violence starts from a poor culture. Mm. And the culture of how you interact with your co-workers will impact how you interact with customers. Mm. And someone who doesn't interact well with customers is likely to be the target of aggression. So if you're noticing one person is routinely getting more aggression than the rest of your team, let's have a look at that straight away, because maybe they just need a little bit of retraining, maybe they're in the wrong role, maybe they shouldn't be customer facing. If we've got a store in a chain that is underperforming in terms of staff retention, let's have a look at the culture that's being developed. Mm. Let's not wait until it spreads throughout the entire organization and that manager who couldn't handle one store is now responsible for 6 stores or 12 stores or a state.
Mm.
Right? And is now changing the culture of the entire organization. It's the exact same thing as a pub fight. Right? Let's see it early, intervene early, and start retraining, recoaching, soft measures that don't require putting two blokes on the floor and calling the cops.
Yeah, that's
or,
right.
Or firing, you know, 6 levels of management because we didn't address the problem beforehand.
Well, that's exactly right. I've often said to staff in organisations, I know that if I was to line up all of your staff in a long line, you and I could walk along in front of those people and you could point out the people that are going to get more aggression mm-hmm. or have more complaints on their file than anyone else. You'd walk along going, yep, she does, he does, she does, he does.
Yep.
And you would know it because of their behaviours. Now let's go there.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me what those behaviours are on a base level. What are their belief systems and values that they're just getting wrong? Are they arrogant, judgmental, dismissive,
mm-hmm.
too weak or too conciliatory? What's going on for those people that is not working? Mm-hmm. Now let's base our understanding of moving forward on stop doing that. And stop doing it with each other in a cultural sense. And let's see how we go tomorrow, you know. So it really sometimes is going to boil down to the most fundamental issues that you've got people in retail. Do you want to be in retail in the first place? Do you want to turn up and put on a smile and wear that smile for 10 hours today
mm.
in the face of just random members of the public asking dumb questions? And
yep. I mean, look, if you did a survey of frontline retail workers
yep.
and you asked them, where do you see yourself in 5 years? What percentage do you think will say, I'm still working retail? Right? So you already got a challenge.
Yeah, 100%.
If you said, went to healthcare workers and said, how many of you still see yourself in this profession in 5 years? Majority of them would say yes.
Yeah,
right? Because they've invested time to get there. It's not by accident. It's not just something that pays the bills and only requires me to work 2 days a week.
Highly trained.
Exactly. You know, yeah. You don't accidentally get a nursing degree.
No, right? No, that's right.
That takes a bit of sacrifice.
Yeah.
I think probably one of the biggest frustrations for me in occupational violence, and I know you've been in the field a long time as well, so you'll connect with this. I've been playing in this space for about 15 years and no one wanted to hear about it. 10 years ago,
mm.
right? It wasn't even on a risk register. No one had occupational violence down as a risk register other than maybe corrections, police, healthcare, paramedics, maybe, right? Mm. Those are about the only areas that had any desire to do any sort of training in it. And now it's becoming acknowledged as a problem, which is great, right? It's a safety risk like any other.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a security risk and it's a corporate espionage risk. There's a whole bunch of other stuff that goes into it. But we want to be able to, when I say we, I'm talking about the risk profession in general, looks at it as how do we just apply a treatment and cover that? I know, we'll print out some signs and we'll stick them on the glass doors
yeah.
saying we don't tolerate aggression. That'll help. You have to have an integrated approach. It has to have buy-in from all levels of management. It has to have buy-in from your staff. It has to have buy-in from your community representatives. It has to come. It has to be more than a sign on the door, because I ignore that sign the second time I see it. And if I was going to come in and rip your head off because I didn't like the service, then I probably was too angry to read your bloody sign. If I did read the sign, I go, you're right. Those people are really out of line, but I've got a legitimate grievance.
Yeah.
Right. So therefore, this doesn't apply to me, right? So those levels of control, or we're just going to get a security guard, and we're not going to care whether he's subcontracted, paid minimum wage, whatever. Like, we've got a security guard, we've solved the problem. Or we've got duress buttons, that solves the problem. These are layers of control. They're individual treatments that need to be part of a treatment plan that has to have oversight and buy-in and a long-term vision of where we're going to go with it. Because those individual layers that just let you tick a box and say, we've addressed that risk, they don't solve anything. You're wasting money. You may as well do nothing.
It's like that Swiss cheese model, isn't it?
Each
of those layers has holes in it.
Mm.
Then something's going to get through that hole and then hit the next layer and find a hole and get through that hole and just keep going until it gets to somewhere.
That's right. You just need to have enough layers damage. And the holes don't line up. That's all it is.
Well, that's exactly right. So at least it bumps into a layer. And those layers we're talking about, you're right, are the human layer. How your HR, how are you engaging with your people? How are you training them? What's the culture you're building around them and the change? Your hiring and your firing and all of those things, your performance management, your KPIs. How are we doing all that human stuff? But there's also policy. How do you feel about the policies you've come across in a lot of the organizations you work with?
Cut and paste.
Yeah.
Majority of them. Yeah. I mean, we have zero tolerance. Show me the proof. Where's the proof that you have zero tolerance?
Yeah.
What actions did you take when you last had an incident? And this is another one I've got, so I can get on a soapbox about. Our staff are our number one priority. Show me your training budget.
Yeah.
Is your training budget as big as your logistics? Yeah. What about your... Let's have a look at where your training is. Because if your people are your number one priority, what are you investing in keeping them safe?
Yes, correct.
And developing them and improving their skills.
And asking the trained people to stay.
Exactly.
If we're saying that your people are your number one priority, and you've acknowledged as an organization that it costs $100,000 to train and to outfit every employee, then what are you doing to keep that trained person there? And I mean, it's a flippant statement, that sort of meme idea that I'm not a big fan of. But if you don't want to train them in case they upskill and leave,
or they stay and they're useless.
Yeah. What are you going to do if they untrained and stay?
Exactly.
And so, yeah, so it's very much that I find the cut and paste idea, and also the definitions they place, like you said, and I was going to go there, zero tolerance. What does that mean to you? What does zero tolerance mean?
Of what? Yeah. And how are we defining violence, right? And this is occupational violence and aggression, OVA. What is it? Like, what does it look like? And this is part of the reason that, so we haven't mentioned it, but I was part of a research team that put together with the Australian Security Research Centre an occupational violence and aggression and duty of care in Australia was the research report. Mm. And we... as far as we know, is the largest ever multi-sector study on occupational violence in Australia. And just doing the research, it was really interesting just to like, well, what are we defining as occupational violence and aggression?
Mm.
A lot of people's like, well, if no one got hit, it wasn't occupational violence and aggression. But what we found quite adamantly was that the largest impact of occupational violence and aggression wasn't physical injury and lost time injuries. It was mental health. It was morale, it was staff retention, it was people's families being impacted by their spouse or loved one being assaulted at work and then having fear and about what's going to happen next time.
Mm.
I mean, talk to anyone who's been married to a police officer, right? That's the biggest fear, is what's going to happen to them while they're at work.
Mm-hmm.
So
also the threat that I might walk to you and say to you, I'm going to strike you.
That's right.
You have, in that moment, very few tools, most of us do, have very few tools to determine whether that's a real threat or not in that moment.
Mm.
So to say, did you end up being struck or not? Was there a battery involved in that assault? Well, the people are getting the message incorrect. We're not looking for physical injury. We're talking about a broader definition.
Exactly. I mean, if you've got staff retention issues, there's something going on. right? Yeah. And we look at all this stuff. But I mean, that was one of the things that came out of the report, was that our attitude towards it is more important than what control measures you put in place.
Yeah.
One thing that really warrants further study is how we go about changing attitudes towards it. Because one of the sectors we did study was the security industry, along with healthcare. There has been a lot more research in healthcare already, so we didn't go deep there.
Yes.
But most security respondents said that they, and this was guards across the whole industry, not just nightclubs and so on. So a lot of these people are working in loss prevention, or they're working in patrols, or other areas. But quite a large percentage of them said they were exposed to violence and aggression at least 5 times a year, which we classified as frequent. If that's the case, you would expect them to say it's a problem. Majority of them said it's not a problem, it's just part of the job.
Yeah.
So that's good from a resilience point of view.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, if I was suddenly put in charge of security for a nightclub again, which God willing I never will be, but if that were to happen to me, I would want people that are not going to fall apart when there's an issue of violence. But is it not reminiscent of the attitude that we had towards working at Heights 50 years ago?
Yeah.
So, well, some people are going to fall to their death because we're working at Heights, right? That's what's going to happen because we're a long way up.
Let's get people that have no fear of heights.
Exactly, right? We've all seen pictures of the construction of the Sydney Harbour Bridge. Yeah,
of course.
Yeah, the Empire State Building and workers having their lunch on beams with no harnesses. And, we've seen those pictures, right? We go, wow, how crazy is that, right? But they accepted that was just a risk of the job. My question is, if we can look at that and go, no, that's not an acceptable attitude, how do we do the same thing when it comes to violence and aggression?
Well, I think we've got to say to ourselves, we look at that 50 years ago.
Mm.
What are people going to think in 50 years of our time?
Exactly.
Mm.
Yeah. And society is just an extension of individual experience. And I look at, I've always been a prolific writer. I've always written a lot of stuff. And I look at some of the stuff I wrote when I was 20, and I'm like, holy crap, I was an idiot. Like, I thought I had it all figured out. Like, I remember being so confident that I had...
Of course.
I mean, I knew a lot about parenting before I had any kids. But and then you have one child and, like, the world falls apart.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, I see why people do this now. I'm never going to let my kids have this. It's like, no. Yeah. You know nothing yet. And I often make the joke, when I turn 30, I look back on my stuff and I was like, wow, I can't wait to turn 40 and figure out how dumb I am now. Like, and I can't wait to be 50 and look back at how dumb I am now that I think I've got some insights, right? And that's just how society moves, I think. Like, every generation thinks they're more progressive than their parents. And everyone's kids are going to think they're more progressive than they are.
Yeah, and it's funny because I find that a lot of them are now saying we need to go back to old world values. So I think there's a quickening of the pace in culture in many ways, that people are feeling a sense that the reins of the horse are getting out of their hands.
Mm.
That we're losing control of the steering, somehow. And so a lot of people are saying, well, hang on, let's just ease the horses back a little bit and let's revisit old world values. But it's always old world values. Nobody says old world technology.
That's right. Yeah. I want to live like my great grandparents, but with an iPod, please.
Yes, that's right. I'm not even prepared to go back to black and white TV or no Netflix or no internet. But
I want to protest climate change, but I don't want to stop using technology.
Yeah, that's right. Well, yes, of course. And I do see there's a dichotomy there, because obviously we can have better technology that has less impact on climate. So we don't need to be going to those, areas where we're digging up these wonderful wilderness areas in order to find the lithium that feeds the batteries or whatever it is. So I do agree that there are ways, but I find it really interesting that most of society today are going, let's just pump the brakes a little bit on where we're going.
I think what that comes back to is a basic human need for control. And I feel like especially the last 30 years since the internet, really, the birth of the internet made everything else exponential.
Yeah.
Like, every development, every technology breakthrough speeds up the next one and the next one and the next one.
Yeah.
And now the rate of growth is controlled by so few and understood by so few that if you're not in that space and you don't really understand what's happening, everything is so rapid and out of control for you that it's actually becoming scary.
Yeah.
Right? And I think every generation reaches a point where it gives up on new technology. Like, I know for my mum, it was about the transition from VHS to DVD. At that point, she was like, I'm out, Right? Yeah. So I've got children now who tell me how to use devices after this.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Dad held on slightly longer, but it is interesting that as we start to feel like we don't have our hands on the reins anymore, and that it's being run by these boffins in labs in Silicon Valley or whatever, and they're controlling the future, that those of us who aren't involved in the process are going to pull back.
Yeah.
And
do you think as well that there's a sense that, so I'm going to multi-layer this question, so please bear with me, guy, and I apologize, that there's a sense that there's a resilience affected by the fact that, number one, there's a lot of existential crises at the moment. There's nuclear proliferation, there's climate change, there's pandemics, you know, and the fact that, you know, it looks like antibiotics might be on the decline, you know, in society. There's still war, there's famine problems. We're draining or drying up the oceans of fish and seafood, so there's going to be issues feeding people the more society grows. But so not only are there all these existential crises, but we also are incredibly aware of them through social media and through the internet. And now we're getting that plugged into our kids who are filled with angst.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what's going on in the world. I'm not even sure if we're going to survive. How the hell do we do this?
Yep.
And they then grow up and become young adults and go on the march, because they're fed it by, and here's my next point, a social media that's developed an algorithm that says, let's ramp everything up to the outrageous, let's create everything so that it is viral, and the only way to do that is to get people outraged and make it controversial. And so what we have is a societal lack of resilience at the moment towards things that we've created, we've enacted, and to now bring my question to a point, does all of that information make you feel like we as a culture move very quickly, but we as an emotional creature and as an evolving bio creature are emotionally evolving incredibly slowly, and our ability to adapt to this high-speed tech change, our emotional ability to cope with the change of the culture is, and they're competing, they're at odds.
Yeah, I agree. I think that we are basically still the same as we were 10,000 years ago.
Yeah.
Like our emotions react exactly the same. We're fearful of the exact same things. We base decisions off very simple things. I live and die, social acceptance or not, because being socially accepted was very, very important when you relied upon a tribe to keep you safe, because if you were an outcast 10,000 years ago, then you were going to be lunched very soon, because no one's going to come protect you. Right? You're not going to be included in the hunting rewards.
And that's the same for every species. Yeah, if you were a wolf, that works exactly the same.
Exactly, right? So we're pack animals. So much of what goes on in our psyche can be connected back to that prehistoric chain of survival. But I think, so a couple of points about what you made. So, social media is certainly a game changer, or even just global media. So the ability to see what's going on in the world, and as long as news channels, whether it's TV news or streamed news or newspapers, as long as they're selling advertising, you can never really trust them, right? Mm. Because they're always going to be governed financially by how many clicks they're getting.
An agenda.
And that's just the nature of the world, right? And then can you trust it any better if they don't sell it and they're controlled by the government? No. So what's the alternative?
Well, the alternative seems to be, let's not trust them at all.
Let's not trust them at all.
Anyone.
And now we've got people that are not obeying public health directions because they think everything is a scam, and everything's a manipulation, and who's right and who's crazy, who knows. So you look at that. I mean, I don't think ancient China was too concerned about volcanoes in Pompeii, right? That was a major world-changing event that right now would be catastrophic.
Mm.
Their civilization moved on without a hitch because they were... I never even heard about it till 400 years later when someone said, did you know about this? Right? Mm. Didn't impact their quality of life. Today it would.
Mm.
So you look at that and you go, it's interesting. And what's more concerning for me as a security-minded person is the way that social media can be manipulated. And so we're seeing this with bot farms. We're seeing this with fake posts that are... We know the Russians are doing it. We know the Chinese are doing it. We know that every government's got their fingers in the pie of stirring up different little controversies or making sure different stories trend or releasing leaked documents at strategic times through strategic means and feeding conspiracy theorists. And look, I see what's happening in the US as a 20-year plan. Like, this is the fruition. Bin Laden wrote in 1996 that the way to destroy America was to turn them on themselves.
Mm.
He said, in 1996, he wrote, saying, no military will ever be strong enough to defeat the United States at war, but if we turn them upon themselves, they will destroy themselves.
Mm-hmm.
Bin Laden wrote that in 1996.
Mm-hmm.
And what did he do in 2001? He drew America into a war that divided them.
Mm-hmm. Exactly right. And I think there was somebody that told me this. Now, I don't know, and perhaps you can correct me if I'm wrong. Somebody had said that he got that from Sun Tzu.
Yeah, probably.
Yeah.
Makes sense. Okay. I mean, he was a scholar. He was well-educated.
Yes, he was. He was educated in the West.
Exactly, yeah. Mm. Yeah. So you look at that, and you look at now the learnings that have come from this, and also even the age of societies make a difference in how they interact with each other. America runs in 4-year cycles,
mm-hmm.
right? A president gets in, he gets his job, he gets his feet under him. I'm not talking about current presidents, but like any president, mm-hmm. they get their feet under them, they have about 2 years to do something, and then the last year of their term is about fighting to keep their job. Mm-hmm. And then they might have another 3 years after that where they don't have to worry about keeping their job so they can actually do something. So you usually see the last 3 years of an 8-year presidency tends to be the most productive.
Mm-hmm.
But that said... Or alternatively, they start setting things up for themselves and their own interests afterwards. That's a different topic. But they're working in 4-year cycles. Countries that don't have to worry about a 4-year cycle, such as dictatorships or quasi-democracies, where power is going to be stable, and a country like China that has a 4,000-year history and works in dynasties, they're not worried about beating the US today or tomorrow or by 2021. They're worried. They're thinking generationally.
They're playing the long game.
Yeah, and China knows that going to war with America and with ships and planes and armed forces is a silly game,
mm-hmm.
right? And why bother?
Mm-hmm.
Let's just start choking off their economy. Let's just start winning over some trade partners. Let's start getting Asia back under a little bit of more influence. Let's
buy a lot of American dollars.
Let's poison the water a little bit in America to sort of weaken their own resolve. It's a very Hannibal-esque kind of a approach to warfare. Yeah. But they're using social media instead of drying up, instead of poisoning water holes. They're using social media to make America more toxic.
Yeah.
And they'll spend more resources internally and less externally, allowing China to expand its influence everywhere else.
Yeah.
And then 200 years from now, people are going, yeah, that American empire was pretty interesting.
Yeah. Lasted for 100 years, and it was a pretty good 100 years, as I recall.
Yeah, But like I've said to several people now, I feel like I'm watching the fall of Rome.
Yeah.
Like I feel like I'm a spectator.
Well, isn't that interesting? Because Trump, like him or hate him, he's coming across like a Nero, isn't he? That the whole place is about to burn, and he's just going to go on to sort of be a crazed lunatic and just set fire to the whole place and just chase it down.
Yeah, talk about a guy who's not prone to de-escalation. probably the antithesis of a guy that's going to bring unity and calm.
But, well, he's an interesting character because from a conflict management perspective, he seems only to be able to divide, to deflect, divide, and then to completely turn the claws back. He's created this whole fake news thing that we live in by calling it... He threw a label on it.
Exactly.
And now everybody's run with it. And so it's interesting, and I was talking to the family only the other day about deepfake.
Mm-hmm.
And imagine when deepfake comes out.
That's scary.
It is scary because here we are in a world where anything can be said about you with video footage to support it.
Yep.
And nothing you can do says that's a fake because it's so deep that they can't tell. Even the experts can't tell.
That's terrifying. My parents still click on suspicious links in their email, right? So how am I going to get them to distrust video?
Yeah. Correct.
How do you do that?
Correct.
And even educated people, like you said, we're going to fall for it.
Yeah.
Because the artistry of it will be to craft something that seems plausible enough that's just on the edge of what you'd expect that person to do.
Yeah.
And that's going to be like a wild, flippant statement, like, yeah, Obama converting to Islam or something, right? Yeah. You're going to go, ah, okay, that fits an agenda. I don't buy that. But, yeah. Like if it's something just on the edge of their personality, that's where the damage is going
to
be done.
Yeah, and that's exactly right. And all they've got to do is have Obama deep fake a footage of Obama attending at a mosque or, you know, seen through a window wearing
some sort of,
you know, it's that sort of thing. And people are going to go, see, and there are already people who have bought right into that idea.
Yeah, of course, because it supports the ideology they've already got.
Yeah.
And that's going to be And that's how you do it. This is basically how this manipulation works, is you pick people that want to believe something really badly and you give them just enough evidence so they can run with it.
Yes.
And then let them go spread your message for you.
And you give them the power to say, if you challenge that you are, just to use common terms being thrown around, you challenge me on anything, you're a libtard.
Yep.
Or you're a fascist.
Yep.
Or you're Antifa. Or yep. you're... you know, you're a communist,
yep.
you're a socialist agitator, you're yep. Whatever you are. And so all I've got to do is I've got to put the evidence out. When you disagree, I go,
yep.
bang.
Yep.
And you just strawman them the whole time.
Mm-hmm.
And this is what Trump has done. He's an expert at it. And
it's
quite fascinating a study to watch him handle anyone. And it's the first time I've ever seen a president do this, where a journalist will say, what about this? And he'll go, that's a very rude question.
Yeah.
Who are you to ask questions like that? In fact, I remember, I've read some stuff on you. You're all about fake news, aren't you? And who do you work for? CNN. Well, isn't that typical? Next question.
Yeah.
And he just...
Just destroys the individual.
Yeah.
He dodges a question. Yeah. I had hopes that Trump...
Me too.
Like when he came in, I thought it's gonna be an interesting ride. I mean, I was thinking, geez, what if Trump gets in there and Clive Palmer gets in here at the same time? It's gonna be interesting. But what gave me hope initially was the people he put around him. I thought, okay, this is a guy who recognizes he doesn't have political experience, and he's brought in all these generals and people that have legitimate careers behind them that I think will make good decisions. Then one by one, they all either quit or got fired. You're like, okay.
Oh, you slashed at
them. When you look at any leader who surrounds themselves with experts, and then in 18 months' time, all the experts are gone, there's something to be read into that.
And some of them were charged, and he ridiculed some of them in the news, and he went after them.
The thing that's most scary about that, and you may want to edit this part out of the podcast, but the thing that's most scary about that is his supporters are cult-like.
Yes.
Like, you got a guy like General Jim Mattis.
Yeah. Right?
I've got all the respect in the world for Jim Mattis. I think if he ran for president now, he would win as an independent if he had the money to do it. I think he's a brilliant human being, a brilliant leader, probably the perfect guy to lead a country given the challenges it has right now. That said, when he was elected as Secretary of Defense, people, the Republican Party embraced him with open arms. This guy's he's a hero. He's this, he's that. He came out and said that Trump was a threat to the Constitution after he resigned.
Yeah.
In fact, in his book, he actually said, in the preface to the book, he said that he wouldn't be commenting on Trump in the book because he didn't believe that it was appropriate for a member of government to speak poorly of a sitting president. Right.
Yeah.
So I would. Yeah, you read into it what you want.
Yeah, between the lines.
Yeah. But now that he's out, he basically said that I can't sit idly by because I believe that President Trump is a threat to the Constitution of America. And I've actually had American friends say it's a real shame what's happened to Mattis.
Yes.
Like, well, what do you mean? He's obviously got advanced PTSD or Alzheimer's because he's saying these things about the president. Right. I was like, no, he's just got a different opinion. It's like, well, as I said, he's clearly mentally ill. Okay. Because he's saying bad things about the president, but he's a war hero, so therefore he can't be a bad person because that is cognitive dissonance, so we have to assign some sort of label to his mental health and go, it's a real shame what's happened to him. He was such a good guy, and now he's saying bad things about the president. There must be something wrong
with him. And of course, they're doing it already with Biden.
And
I get it.
That blows my mind that Biden and Trump are the two options. Right?
Oh, I've said that already.
Well, Kanye West, apparently. Kanye West is.
Oh, well, that's better then.
You know what? Kanye's got a shot.
He does have a shot. Of course he does.
He's got enough money to fund a campaign.
I think if the United States end up with Kanye West, that we're going to see an even more or differently literate, perhaps, because I don't think Trump is particularly literate.
Mm.
But I think that Kanye West is differently literate. And I'm just not sure that they need another celebrity in office.
No, but if there's ever a chance, if there was ever a time you could engineer a Kanye West presidency as an independent, it would be right now when he has zero competition in terms of likability, and he would get a sizable portion of the African American vote. Although he has been a Trump supporter in the past, so maybe not. I don't know. He is.
He's often seen in the office shaking hands with the president and things like that.
He does own a wardrobe of MAGA hats. So I don't know. I don't know. Maybe it's a publicity thing. Actually, Mike Shinoda from LinkedIn tweeted this morning. He said, "I'm also running for president," and he put a star at the end of it, saying, "I mean, I've got a new album coming out."
That's right.
So it's probably a nice publicity tool to draw some attention his way in the. For whatever his new release is.
Is it interesting that he's been has so many MAGA hats, he's been an advocate of the president, has been shaking hands and hugging the president and all that, and then suddenly he runs as an independent?
Yeah.
It's a fascinating system, the US system. I just think that the whole cultural, socioeconomic, psychosocial aspect, the whole country at the moment is in this terrible turmoil, and I think it's going to be fascinating to watch, and people are really suffering, and that's the thing that I sort of wanted to address is when we talk about resilience, people are being met by some of the worst times that a first world leading economy, leading superpower, stable nation should ever face.
Yeah, and there's also, coming back to what you were saying before about social media, I think that is such a crucial element of this, because from what I understand, talking to my American friends that are on the ground, and we should caveat this, we're not there.
Right? Yeah.
But, and a large part of what we're commenting on is what makes it to social media or makes it to the mainstream media.
Yeah.
There are large pockets, well, in fact, probably the majority of the country is completely untouched by the turmoil that we see on TV. Same as earlier in this year, we had most Americans thought our entire country was on fire.
Yes. Right?
Because that's all they were seeing was Australia's on fire. And certainly there were unprecedented bushfires, and it's not to minimise those, but yeah, we were fine, like where we were. People were, right?
The crazy graphics that they put up map of Australia and all these huge flames. All of it's on fire,
including like areas where there's no foliage whatsoever. Right? Yeah, the desert's on fire somehow. It was going to be glass soon. We've got to be cognizant of that. But for the average American who's waking up every morning and being getting this deluge of hate and vitriol and division, I firmly believe that in pretty much every country, your centralists make up your majority. Right. Yeah. And I'd consider myself a centralist. Probably depending on what stage in my life I've been at, I'm either right leaning or left leaning, but I've always been somewhere in the center. And I always like to do those political compass checks every couple of years just to see like who I line up with best at the moment. But I think that's probably the scary thing, because it's actually social media is putting us in an artificial sense of fight or flight every day.
Mm.
And we're now concerned every day about what's happening in our world, what's going on with COVID, how many new cases have there been today? Am I going to be in lockdown today? Oh, what's happening in the United States? Are my friends over there going to be okay? What happens if the American economy falls? What happens if China takes over? Does that change how things work? And what's happening in Europe? Is Brexit still a thing? Is Brexit still happening? Why is there a mop in charge of Britain? Like there's all these things, right, that you're looking at going, I can't keep up.
I think
so. I'm stressed.
Yes. And I think the biggest thing is that we can't control the fact that Facebook itself gives us a hit of dopamine with all the likes, and then there's cortisol with all the fear. Yep. And then there's dopamine because I got a like and I posted something that people love. And now there's cortisol because the world's dying. And there's dopamine because my friend said they love me and happy birthday. And there's cortisol because...
Yeah. And there's so much fascinating research into how social media has been constructed to deliberately hit all those points.
Yeah.
It's really fascinating.
The algorithms really, and I wonder...
It's weaponized marketing.
Well, and we are the product.
Yeah.
I don't like that. I'm old enough to remember what it feels like to live in a world where I'm not a product.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't like the feeling. I also don't think it's good for society. I think we could rewind the clock, start again in 2009 without a Facebook, and right now would be a better world.
Yes.
I think if that was the one change we took out of the world from 2009 was just to go, Zuckerberg doesn't ever release that.
Yep.
Boom, his life wouldn't be perhaps as good. And many, many billionaires and all of that. But I someone else would step in, but it might be slightly different.
Maybe, yeah. It's really hard to tell whether if he didn't do it, someone else would have. Maybe it would have done it worse. Maybe it would have been more corrupt. It's really hard.
Snapchat, was that the other? That was
MySpace. MySpace was there first.
MySpace, that's right.
But they didn't have the same ambitions. Uh-uh. I think the difference is Zuckerberg, despite what the movie says, from all legitimate accounts, always saw it as a long-term marketing platform, not
is that right?
A social media platform. It wasn't about connecting people. MySpace was about connecting people and sharing music initially. Whereas Facebook, I think Zuckerberg always had in the back of his mind, or maybe not early when it was a college thing, but once he saw the growth, I think that very early the wheels turned to, how do we get people to tell us more about themselves so we can do targeted marketing?
Wow.
And that's basically everything since then has been a growth of that, to the point now where Facebook is just part of life. Like, it's not even you opt in or you opt out. It's like you're born into it almost. It's just, it's like, are you reading the newspaper?
Yeah.
Like, the only time I bought a newspaper in the last 2 years has been when there's been an article in there that I wanted to get a photo of.
Yeah, right.
Or I've been in it. Yeah, those are like the only times I've bought a newspaper.
Yeah.
Because all my news comes predominantly through social media.
Yeah.
And predominantly that's through Facebook. So they can control what I know unless I have the desire. Like, sometimes I'll go look for something in particular. Like, for example, at the moment with COVID, like, I'm checking independent sources and I'm watching the live broadcast to get up-to-date information. But if it's stuff that's only on the peripherals of my interest, and it doesn't seem too outlandish, I'll probably just accept it because it seems plausible enough.
Well, here's the thing.
I ain't got so much time.
We also have been raised that your parents knew stuff that you didn't know. Your teachers knew stuff that you didn't know. You went to the doctor because he knows stuff you don't know. You go to the accountant because he knows stuff that you don't know. So there's all of this, there's all of these other things there's all of these other places that you go and you find expert opinion.
Mm.
And yet now expert opinion is under threat.
Well, yeah, we're just talking about the, offline, we're talking about the dissolution of STEM. And the fact that people think they've done research because they Googled videos that they've Googled something like, why are vaccines bad?
Yes.
And they got a bunch of videos saying vaccines are bad, therefore I've researched it.
Yeah.
The person who spent the last 30 years of their life in intense academic study with 3 PhDs and 40 referenced peer-reviewed articles.
And a Nobel Prize.
It's like, he says something on TV, but that's bullshit because he's a big pharma. I spent a whole afternoon on YouTube and I found all these people, some of whom were wearing lab coats, telling me that it was wrong. We've completely taken away, and there's, again, everything's a double-edged sword, everything's a dichotomy. On one hand, you don't want to have blind adherence to authority because then you end up in situations like, Nazi Germany.
Yes.
But some sort of respect for authority goes a long way.
Yes.
Right? We don't trust police anymore. Like, people don't respect the police anymore. People don't respect their teachers anymore. We don't respect lawyers anymore. We don't respect anybody. Like, we can have a doctor tell you information, but if it doesn't suit your worldview, it's like, well, I don't want to take those pills. I don't think I need them. I think he's just getting paid to prescribe them for me. Yeah. Okay, cool. Then don't go to him. No problem. But when you start impacting other people's quality of life with your distrust, that's when it gets interesting.
Yeah, and this is what I mean about that movement, and you mentioned STEM. The whole dismantling, or if there's a movement towards saying there's something wrong with science. Mm. Now, there might be wrong with some people within science.
Mm.
There might even be wrong with some doctrines of science. There have been things in science that have been disproven. But the thing that makes science worthwhile is that the mechanism of science says, I'm going to come up with a hypothesis.
Yeah.
but I'm not going to go anywhere with it until I've thrown it to the rest of the scientific community for a review.
Mm-hmm.
And if there's something wrong, I say, thank you, good to know, because I'm now better as a scientist. My whole worldview as a scientist has been enriched, and I am now better at what I do because I found out I was wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that there as a model for everything else that we do in society
absolutely
has been amazing. So to dismantle STEM, science itself, on the basis that it is prejudicial because it's an old white man system, is ludicrous. I understand that it was old white men, but even, let's be honest, a lot of science started in Arab communities.
Absolutely. Yeah, like, yeah,
hence algebra.
Yeah. Absolutely. I mean,
the word algebra is...
Mathematics, like everything came from either Middle East or Greece or...
Yeah.
Yeah, there's that pocket. Yeah.
So you can't just say old white men.
Well, you can if you want to. You're wrong.
You can. Yeah. You can. You can even build a placard around it. Doesn't it make you right?
We can say history is racist, but then you fail to learn the lessons from it.
Yes.
I mean, that's what we've got to be careful of, is that, yes, history as we know it.
Yeah.
History is always written by the winners, right? Yeah. So there's always a bias. Every story that's ever told has a bias. You can read Caesar's memoirs of the Gallic Wars. And it's the only first-hand account we have of that entire conflict.
Oh, yeah.
And it's brilliant because it has so much detail, because it's the only first-hand account. But it's also the most biased possible account because it's written by the guy who had the most gain by telling a compelling narrative about what happened.
Yeah, that's right.
So what do? Do you just pretend it didn't happen at all and ignore the lessons?
Yeah.
Or do you just learn to think critically and go, what makes sense and what doesn't?
Yeah.
There's always going to be inaccuracies in history. There's always going to be people that are downplayed and overplayed. There's always going to be people that get credit for things that weren't theirs. And you're going to get people that, like a Nikola Tesla, who should get more credit but doesn't or didn't until recent years. Mm. There's always going to be that, and people are going to be made heroes that shouldn't be heroes. That's always going to be the case. But it's about taking away the cult of worshipping personalities and more about drawing the lessons from the stories. This is what happened, this chain of events happened, what lessons can we draw from that? Because otherwise we're doomed to repeat it. And if we just detach from who the individuals were and who deserves credit and who doesn't deserve credit, then we can learn from it without having to worry too much about whether Winston Churchill was the greatest wartime leader in history or whether he was a racist bigot. Right?
Yeah, and that's playing the ball and not playing the man and not the ball. We need to play the ball, and it's really about going, okay, from a balanced perspective, Winston Churchill had tremendous flaws, but he had tremendous benefits as well, features to his character, and he did some amazing things amid some dumb stuff.
Yep.
And that's all of us.
Exactly.
And now if we go back through history and we go, okay, Hitler, okay, probably on a base level, he was misguided and misled.
Mm-hmm.
He did some amazing things, and he brought a population together, and he rose. Okay, so there's that. Let's have that discussion as well as the discussion that says, okay, his belief in a supreme race and his persecution of the Jewish based on silly nonsense that he was raised with, all of that stuff is bad. We can objectively say that's bad, but it has to be a more balanced view. And what I find nowadays is people plonk themselves in a camp.
Mm.
I am a conservative, therefore, everything to the left of me becomes intolerable.
Yes.
So even if I'm slightly right, not slightly right, if I'm right-winged, anybody centrist looks like they're completely left-wing to me.
Yep.
And anybody who's actually left-wing, well, they might as well be a communist.
That's right.
Yeah. But plonking themselves in a camp, instead of saying, like you do, where's my gauge and let me temperature check how I feel about the politics of the day.
And
they need to bear in mind as well, as we all do, that whatever political parties are in existence at the moment, many of the policies, the opposite party used to have.
Yes.
Go back a couple of generations, and there are many, many policies that have been swapped.
Mm-hmm.
And there are many policies they shared. And do you know, in the 50s, there was a complaint that the two parties were too closely aligned.
Mm-hmm.
But they actually wanted the parties to be more distinctive.
Give more choice.
To give more choice to voters. That doesn't, you know, so we can plonk ourselves in a camp now and we raise a flag and we point fingers at everyone else. It's unhealthy.
Yeah, and I think that it's lazy. And
it's easy.
It is, yeah. I mean, you could, to use Hitler as an example, right? It's very easy to say Hitler was evil. And I think if you're going to say that any one human being in history was evil, there's a pretty compelling case. But by saying he's evil and then using that as an excuse not to learn from what happened,
yeah,
that's laziness. Say, well, he was evil, he's an outlier. Well, no, because how did he get a broken country to become a military power in 20 years? How did he get so much popular support? How did he fix their education system and their infrastructure?
Not only in 20 years, they were decimated after World War I.
The 20 years like gap between the wars.
But they were behind the eight ball even. They started from behind the eight ball.
And how did he parlay broken, embarrassed people into what he created?
Yeah.
And really, without the destruction of Germany in World War I, you don't end up with a Germany of World War II.
Yeah.
Because they were humiliated.
Yeah. They were broken.
I mean, and look, let's talk about, since we're in World War II, let's talk about Japan. Yeah. Right? There were some tremendous evil things that took place by Japanese troops in the early 20th century. Right, throughout Asia and then into the Pacific War. But I can't help but marvel at a country that was essentially medieval.
Yeah.
Up until 1886.
Yeah.
That in a period of 20 years became a real global power and then nearly owned a good portion of the world 20 years after that.
Yeah.
Unbelievable. Like, no civilization has done that.
Yeah.
Now, does that morally excuse anything? No, of course not. But there's lessons to be learned about how it was done.
I think one of the lessons is, as we discussed earlier, that as a technology and as a culture, we can move very quickly. But as an emotional creature, our ability to stop and analyze and say, should I be doing this shit? I've built this incredible weapon. Should I use it in the first place? And is world domination really what it's all cut out to be? And, you know, when we were talking offline about Japan being offered the top half of Australia, you know, during World War II. If we were going to lose Australia, we basically were going to say, right, well, you know, you take down to Brisbane and we'll have the rest. And them having to go, oh, geez, can we even manage that country?
Yep.
Why would we want that large slab of desert? And how do we create an infrastructure there? And how do we create trade routes and things? How do we even manage that? Yep. Do we want it? But no, they do it because their psyche, this very primitive thing that says, you know, must hunt, must kill, must own, must beat you. And so we have this incredible ability to develop technology, but an incredible capacity to be so stupid as to not know how to use it.
Yeah, I mean, human nature is like the one thing that's universal. It's universal and it's everlasting. And I'll bring this back to a modern day point in a second, but like you look at Caesar's growth of the Roman Empire. Caesar, and for those wondering how we got onto this topic, we're talking offline about how we both love history, so hence we're here. But Caesar was constantly putting out fires on his border. And the way that he went about putting out fires on his border was whatever he was bordering, he would end up invading that territory, pacifying those people and absorbing them into the empire, which makes sense because you don't want to have enemies on your doorstep. Unfortunately, what that meant is as he got the new territory, he then inherited the neighbors that were on their doorstep. So he was continually having to expand without any real...
create safety.
Basically, he could have, I don't know whether he had desire to expand the empire or not. He wasn't exactly Alexander the Great, but he was, similarly minded. But a large portion of the wars he got into were basically self-defense wars as a way to stabilize his borders. But every time he stabilized a border, he inherited a new border, right? So the human nature of wanting to control that which can immediately hurt us is universal, no matter how big you get and how scary you get and how well-developed your empire is and how many people you lose in the process. And we come back to the modern day, and this is an argument that I have, or I won't say an argument because arguments don't get you anywhere in this particular field, but it's a case I try to make on a regular basis, is that in risk management, in corporate risk management or security management or safety management, if you play catch up with technology, you are always behind.
Yes.
If you're constantly investing in what's my next my words are failing me. What's my next technological control for these next threats?
Mm.
Then you're only ever going to be one. The best you can be is one step behind the bad guys, because you're only defend against the threats you know about.
Yes, right? That's
like,
right.
It's like drug testing in the Olympics, right? Yeah. You can only test for the drugs you know exist.
Yeah.
So hence why drug tests are usually 8 to 12 years behind, because they need to catch people taking those drugs to know they've got to take, got to test for them.
That's right. Right. And the hackers that are getting into toll most recently. Yep. You know, got hacked because they've got these viral software that the ransomware that gets in.
Yeah, I mean, you can red team it, and you can try and find those gaps preemptively. But it, generally speaking, you're going to be one step behind, and your hope is that the people that are one step ahead of you are not big enough to hurt you that badly, or they hurt someone else first, and then you improve your systems. But the one thing that's universal that doesn't change with technology is human nature.
Mm-hmm.
And at the end of the day, the best firewalls in the world will not prevent a stupid person from making a mistake.
Yes, that's right.
Right. Everybody occasionally leaves the office with a heater on, right?
Yeah, well, that's right. Sharing a password or leaving or
buying cheap CCTV from China that people can hack into, right?
Yeah.
You can have all the best systems in the world, but if you've got pressure on someone to be budget conscious and they buy cheap gear, based on, I've got $20,000 left in the budget for this year, that's all I can afford to do.
Yeah.
Then you have just created a massive vulnerability.
Yeah.
So the more you invest in your human beings making better decisions, managing their stress better, and being more risk intelligent, the less you have to spend on all the other stuff.
Yeah, that's right.
But it's not sexy. Because you don't see, you can't take someone for a tour and show them your new improved human beings.
No, that's right.
You can take them to a new server room and it looks very fancy. You can't take them and say, well, here's Paul, and 2 years ago he knew SFA. Now he knows a lot of things. Like it's
true. It is true. And really all you can do is say, over time we've noticed a gradual decline in complaints.
Mm-hmm.
We've noticed an upturn in morality and productivity. We've noticed that there are less days off for injury and stress.
Mm-hmm.
And we've noticed that there's a sharp decline in assaults and occupational violence as a result of these things that we've enacted. Mm-hmm. And so the graph shows when that's gone up, that's gone down.
Yeah.
So they are measurable, but it, like you said, it's not sexy. It takes time. It's a cultural shift that quite often requires everybody to shoulder to the wheel. And it's not something that you can buy from a software company and just plug in.
Yeah, and what do you want to take to your shareholders to show off? Do you want to show happier staff, or do you want to show your fleet of drones?
Yeah, that's right.
Right? Like, so, but that's, again, it's understanding human nature is what do shareholders want to see?
Yeah, exactly.
They want to see returns, right? Yeah. So forget the dog and pony show. Show them what their money's doing, right?
Yeah.
And, but look, I think the universal element to all of the things we've discussed is human beings. Like, it doesn't matter whether we're talking politics, war, occupational violence, anything else, as human beings, and understanding how the human mind works and how and why we do the dumb things we do.
Yeah.
That's how we make progress, because we can't keep up with technology anymore.
And it seems to me that of all the things that are wavering in any society at any time that there's a crisis like COVID, and what organizations do, they go, okay, we're just going to hold back on training.
Mm.
Financial crisis. Yeah, we're just going to hold back on training.
Yep.
There's a small recession. Okay, we're just going to hold back on training.
Yep.
And yet, of all the four major categories that I talk about in mine, which is heat, human, environmental, administrative, and technological, they hold the human back.
Mm.
They'll keep the environment. They'll keep the administrative. They'll keep the technology, and they'll buy more software. They'll buy better infrastructure. They'll buy or they'll change their policies and do all that, but they don't do the human.
Mm-hmm.
And I find that really sort of counterproductive, but not in an obvious way.
Yep.
And so you can sit back. It's the forest and the trees argument, isn't it? I can sort of sit back and I look at that and I can see what's happening in the forest, because they're in there, they don't see it.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel in many, many respects that if you're an organization that has any employee base, and you're dealing with customers and you're dealing with clients who are human, that's what's happening, until we get a fleet of drones that are interacting on an AI base that they wrote with AI customers, where humans interacting with humans, we have to understand human nature, human triggers, human behaviors, human responses, the human belief systems and value systems and culture, And we've got to keep that moving all the time.
Exactly. Because at the end of the day, whatever technology comes next is going to be programmed by and used by humans.
Yeah.
And that's always going to be the weak link in the chain.
Yeah.
Like the way that most hacking is done is not systems. It's soft hacking. Of course it is. It's
passwords.
Social engineering.
Yeah.
It's getting access to things you shouldn't have access to because someone gave you the benefit of the doubt. That's how majority of major breaches happen.
Yeah.
Oftentimes they still require physical access to a server room. How do they do that? They don't hack their way in.
No.
They manipulate their way in. And that's just security awareness, risk intelligence, being able to make good decisions.
Yeah.
Basic stuff has been the same ever since we were trying to guard the entrance to a cave.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Yeah. And just people will talk their way in. And all the movies, all the Mission Impossibles are all about that. Putting on a cleaner's uniform and pretending you're someone you're not and convincing somebody that you left your key at home. Mm. Could I borrow yours?
Mm.
And away we go.
And you know what? As soon as we put in a system that prevents that kind of flexibility, we complain.
Yeah, that's right.
As soon as you have a door that you can't get through because there's no one to talk to, and you think you have a legitimate cause, you will raise hell because no one was there to override the system. So as soon as you make things impenetrable, they become inconvenient.
Don't we have a butting heads between extra security and extra control, though?
Oh, absolutely.
And this is what people are...
Absolutely. Everyone wants more security until it becomes inconvenient.
That's right. Well, and then you get the guys who are going, well, hang on, you know, this is Big Brother overseeing and overwatch, and next thing you know, we'll be chipped.
Yep.
We'll be all microchipped, and they'll be able to track us wherever we go. Yeah, hold on, dude.
Yeah.
You know, all we're asking for is an extra password measure or control or something. You know, let's just chill on that. Yeah. There's no doubt that we've allowed certain rights to be eased, personal rights, so that others can help us keep us safe. And there's no doubt that an argument can be raised that a compliant society is more easy to control.
Mm.
It's just finding that balance. Mm. Look, if there's one word I use more than anything in a daily conversation, it's balance. Find a balance.
Mm.
That it's not as bad nor as good as you think.
Mm.
You're not as red party or blue party as you think. The other person is not as horrible and you're not as beautiful as you think. We meet in the middle. You know, Hitler was probably not that great a guy, but he's not the evil that you say he was.
Mm.
Let's try and find somewhere in the middle, be more balanced. I find balance is in my communication, in my understanding of humans. We can be terribly polarizing in our viewpoints. And I think that the more humans come together, the better.
Well, it has to be. And the only thing that happens when we fight each other is we weaken both sides.
Yeah, correct.
Coming back to America again, I mean, the greatest loss of American life ever was in the Civil War.
Yeah, that's right.
Which weakened nobody except America.
Yeah, that's right.
So
yeah,
you can use that, you can extrapolate that to everything else we look at. You know, like no one gains when a husband and wife fight.
Yeah, that's right.
All it does is weaken the family and it weakens society. So the more we can bring each other together and to come full circle way back to the beginning of the conversation, the more we get people to understand how each other think and have empathy.
Yeah.
For where each other is coming from.
Yeah.
And we can do that in our own homes. We can practice that in our own homes. We can teach our kids. We can show empathy in our communities. And eventually, that's where it has to start. It's not going to start at a government level and filter down. It has to filter back up.
Well, it can't be top down because that's just policy.
Exactly.
And
it's only got a 4-year life cycle.
Correct. And if it's bottom up,
then
at least you are able to practice at home with a willing audience and a forgiving audience. So if I'm going to become better communicator, if I'm going to become more empathetic, if I'm going to learn to apologize more, if I'm going to be more self-aware, the time to practice is at home in front of a loving and willing and forgiving audience.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where I learn. Now, once I've learned some strategies, I can start to move into the workplace and use them. And I go, oh, that failed. Let me practice more at home. Okay, now I can get better. And now I can start moving with my strategies through the workplace. But what we have too much is people who are saying, like you might go into a training program, you teach some skills, they go and apply them immediately against the most resistant person, customer they've had for the day. And when they fail, they come back to you and they go, what you said didn't work.
Mm-hmm.
You go, well, hang on. Number one, there's every likelihood that having only just learnt it, that you didn't apply it correctly.
Mm-hmm.
Number two, it's not a cure-all. This is not a magic wand. You know, we're not Harry Potter and you're going bibbidi-bobbidi, whatever you're doing, and that person changes. We are having a dynamic between two people, and I'm trying to influence you and you're trying to influence me, and what we're really doing is creating a shape in the middle here. Mm. But don't expect that it's a miracle cure. You work at it, become better at it, become better able to pick the person that this will work, and also start to learn some strategies for when it starts to fail. You should be able to shift over this direction. And it's like any martial art, you know. Yeah. You stand up with a guy who gets on his toes and starts dancing around, you're going, well, this is Taekwondo.
Yep. Yep.
You move on him and suddenly he drops down and shoots.
Yep.
You go, it's not Taekwondo at all. I better adjust. Now I'm into judo or shoot or MMA and BJJ. Yep. So you get on the ground and suddenly you're rolling around.
Yep.
So it's about adjusting on the fly. Mm. But you give a person a strategy and they use that one strategy.
Yep.
It's, you know, one dart into the board.
That's right. And I think that, again, that's, it just ties back to the stick to what the fundamentals are.
Yeah, that's
right. Everything, right? And we're talking about humans being better to each other on whatever scale. It starts with how we interact with each other. My grandmother, her last words to me before the last time I saw her, before she passed away, was the quote from Gandhi, be the change you want to see in the world.
Yeah, that's right.
And I look at that now as a parent, and I go, I need to raise my kids the way I want the rest of the world to be.
Mm.
And because at the end of the day, it's, you know, in a very pragmatic way, as long as we live in a democracy, eventually people are going to vote for people to share their values.
Mm.
So let's give the kids the values we want to have our leaders showing 20 years from now.
They're the leaders. They're our next generation of leaders.
That's right. So, yeah. I mean, if they're not going to be leading themselves, at least they'll be voting for people that share the same values they have.
Exactly right.
So, and again, that comes back to what behavior we're modeling in the family. What behavior are we extolling to them?
What behavior are we modeling in our organization? What behavior are we modeling in the community? What behavior are we modeling overseas?
And remembering it's not just what you preach, it's what you tolerate.
Yeah, exactly right.
So it's about all, you can say you value something, but where's the proof?
Yeah, demonstrate. Yeah. Well, mate, it's been fascinating. Can I just wind up maybe with, tell people where they can get hold of you. If somebody wants to organize, I don't know, to be a member on your, a guest on your podcast, or sure. On LinkedIn, or
yeah, sure. So I'm always on LinkedIn. Feel free to search me on there, LinkedIn, and I think my profile name is Joe Saunders M.ISRM, member of the Institute of Strategic Risk Management. For personal inquiries, joesaunders.com.au. Anything business or consulting related, risk2solution.com.
Risk2solution. That's the number two in there.
Yes. Risk2solution.com.
Very good, mate. Well, it's been a pleasure meeting you and chatting with you today, and I've learned heaps, and I really thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. I'd be happy to have the conversation anytime.
Well, we've got more to discuss, so maybe that'll happen. Good on you.
Cheers.
All right, mate. See you, everybody. Thanks very much.